Kia ora and welcome to today's Webber Training teleclass. My name is Jane Barnett and it gives me huge pleasure to introduce our speaker today. Dr. Anucha Apisan-Thanarak is currently an associate professor at Somerset University Hospital and chief of infectious disease division at the same institute in Thailand. He also serves as adjunct visiting professor at Division of Infectious Diseases, Washington University School of Medicine in the USA. His research focuses on infection control in resource-limited settings, including control of MDR pathogens, antimicrobial stewardship, epidemiology, and control of emerging infectious diseases, as well as outbreak investigation. He has published more than 120 peer-reviewed articles and more than 20 peer-reviewed book chapters, so very well published. He's been a key committee member of many national and international societies, including the SHEA Planning and Publication Committee, the Editorial Board for Clinical Infectious Diseases and Infection Control, and Hospital Epidemiology Journal, the Thai National Nosocomial Infection Control Group, and Thai National Antimicrobial Resistance Surveillance Center. So he's very well qualified to talk to us today. Welcome, Anucha, and thank you for your contribution to today's teleclass with your session on healthcare-associated infections after major flooding. Expect the unexpected. Over to you.
Thank you, Jane, for your kind introduction. And today I will be focusing on the healthcare-associated infections after major flooding. Expect the unexpected, and the objectives of my talk include first, I would like to share with you the infection after major flooding, and I will focus today mostly on nosocomial infection. Secondly, I would like to share with you how to prevent it. And lastly, I would like to share the main lesson learned that we have learned from our major flooding in the year 2011. For those who are interested in the material, I will upload the PowerPoint in the website that's listed in the slide number 3, and you can upload it in the next few weeks. And first of all, I would like to say that there are many types of natural disaster, including a volcano eruption, the earthquake, cyclone or hurricane, avalanche, flood, tsunami, drought, forest fire or bush fire, landslide and tidal wave, environmental pollution, snowstorm, and epidemic disease. Having said that, we in Thailand experience another type of disaster calling a political disaster that is going on for at least almost 10 years, and the situation is a little bit better now, but not so stable at right now yet. Having said that, as you all know, with the impact of the global warming, disasters are increasing, and all disasters can have an impact on infectious disease transmission. The PowerPoint on the next one is the PowerPoint that shows you that the type of disaster correlated with the infectious disease threat. If you are dealing with the flood, you are dealing with middle degree of infectious disease spread. But if you are dealing with epidemic infection or bioterrorism, you have a high chance of dealing with infectious disease threat. For flooding, the topic today, I would like to share with you a little bit background. And the flood start from the north of Thailand. That water came from the north, and then the water went to the middle of Thailand. It is the city of Ayutthaya, as you see on the bottom of the right. As you can see, the whole city of Ayutthaya is underwater. Eventually, the water came to Pathumthani, a little bit closer to Bangkok. And as you can see here, there are a lot of water there, and also the traffic jam is a big there. The hospital where I work with, named Somerset University Hospital, on the next slide, was flooded about 3 meters high. And not only faculty of medicine that got flooded, but also included a lot of faculty like engineering, architecture, etc., as you see on the photo on the lower right corner. On slide 11, I would like to just share with you that with the flood, sometimes unexpected can be expected. This is the photo of the crocodile that fled from the zoo because the zoo got flooded about 3 meters high as well. So as a result, a lot of dangerous animals get fled out of the zoo and do harm to a lot of people as well. But the impact of the flood can be tremendous to the hospital like us. This is slide number 12 is the photo of the negative pressure unit that was severely damaged by the flood. And on the right is the photo of the trauma unit that was destroyed because it's on the first floor by the black water flood. We eventually cannot salvage the room anymore because there are a lot of damage for over 3 month period of flooding. Eventually, we have to build another first floor and some part of the second floor again because we cannot be ready after flooding. Slide 14, sharing with you the impact of flooding on is everywhere, including the OPD floor and the floor of the medicine unit. And that on slide 15, I would like to emphasize today on three major infections, including the fungal infection, bacterial infections, and mycobacterial infections. And also one of the area of my interest is infection control after major flooding as well. Healthcare-associated infection, the first one that you expected to see is fungal infection. Soon after the hospital decided to open the hospital, we experienced a report from the laboratory notifying us that there are 10 cases of penicillium grow out from the blood culture, and we never experienced this before, and we thought that we might encounter the outbreak situation. So what we did is that we obtained the outbreak data by doing a line listing, and what we found is that we found that all cases have penicillium species detected from emergency department. And we said that none of the patients developed any kind of symptom of fungal infection. They have been diagnosed with pneumonia, tonsillitis, spinal gastroenteritis, dengue, leptospirosis, and etc. But none has been has been infected with fungal infection. So we thought that we are encountering with the situation of pseudo outbreak situation that we have to investigate. The first step for investigating the pseudo outbreak is to make sure that there's no contamination in the laboratory unit. And we talk to the microbiology laboratory, and there is no contamination detected. Having said that, many physicians wondering why pseudo outbreak is a big deal because no one really infected. But for us as an infectious disease physician, it is such a big deal because it impacts a lot of physician decisions. First, what do you do in a patient who will receive a hardware after surgery or cardiac surgery? Or secondly, if my colleague is a hematologist and he treats febrile neutropenia patient, and I told him that the culture that obtained from the patient is fake, is not true, is penicillium, just forgot it, he's not going to believe me and treat the patient with antifungal anyway. So this leading to unnecessary antifungal exposure. And lastly, over that time period, fungal infection was in the differential diagnosis for our nosocomial infection in our hospital because we detected a lot of high fungal burden in the air. What he did in the field is that we went to investigate at the ER, given that all cases had been detected to have the blood culture drawn at ER. The first step that we perform is that we inspect the ER and we found that the emergency room has some damage due to flooding which is unrepaired. And the site that they draw the blood culture is located next to the site that was damaged by the flood. What we did next is that we look at the process of drawing the blood culture, and there's no such compromise in that process. So we thought that there might be something going on, and we looked at the bottle and the container of that people keep the blood culture, and we culture the diaphragm of the blood culture bottle and all of the diaphragm throughout penicillin species. So we had a hypothesis at that time that the fungal isolated from the blood might be related to a high fungal bioburden in the air. So we performed the air sampling and it confirmed our hypothesis that there are a lot of penicillin go out from the air at the site that they draw the blood culture. So clearly, the intervention that we have to do apart from area decontamination in slide 21 is to do additional intervention, including the introduction of hydrogen peroxide vaporizers to decontaminate the air, and also we implement the air filtration at the site that they draw the blood culture, and we have some teaching and observation of the IC compliant to the process of blood culture drawing as well. Slide 22 suggests some special approach for area decontamination and when to use this special approach. Actually, I'm not a big fan of this special approach, but clearly there are some situations that you might consider using this special approach. And in yellow highlight in slide 22, suggests that in special situations like this, like when you're dealing with the EID, when you're dealing with bioterrorism, or when you're dealing with the flood, you might consider using this approach for area decontamination as well. Slide 23, sharing with you the new approach to area decontamination. There are two types that have been published extensively in the literature. The first type is the UV light, and the second type is the hydrogen peroxide vapor on the right. The effectiveness of UV light has been no doubt. It's working very well to eradicate MRSA, VIE, MVI bomb, and CDPCU, spore-forming agents. Having said that, the efficacy of UV light for mold is kind of compromised. It's not working quite good for Aspergillus and Penicillium. So we decided that we do not want to use UV light as an additional intervention that we would like to use. At that time, the only available data in the literature is the use of hydrogen peroxide vapor, and in slide 26, there are some data suggesting that hydrogen peroxide vapor can work in well to eradicate Aspergillus contamination of the patient room. And the author concluded that the dry mist hydrogen peroxide decontamination system should provide facility with an effective method for controlling the spread of infectious diseases, noting that the method can be used both preventively during routine decontamination and as a treatment during infectious disease outbreaks as well. Another data reporting the use of hydrogen peroxide vapor by investigators treating of fungus and bacteria at the site labeled on the left. And as you can see here, after 30 minutes of fumigating the hydrogen peroxide, they did culture the site and they found that the site after fumigating with hydrogen peroxide has achieved a 13-fold decrease in the number of the summation of colony forming units of both bacteria and fungal infection in the room. The next slide on 30 sharing with you the method of using hydrogen peroxide. It is not easy to use when there is a patient available in the room, but at that time there are no patients in the room, and we would like to start using hydrogen peroxide to as a means to decontaminate the area. And it is the photo sharing with you that after we remove all linen and stuff, we have to seal the room tightly, not to let the vaporizer going out, to achieve a maximum concentration of hydrogen peroxide. And on slide 31, we fumigating for 30 minutes and left in there 2.5 hours for contact time. And then in slide 32, before we get into the patient room, we have to monitor the level, and we have to wear appropriate personal protective equipment and measure the level to make sure that the level is less than 1 ppm prior to allowing the patient to take into the room. The next slide sharing with you that if you want to use hydrogen peroxide in a very large area, you need to separate the area that's more than 200 cubic meter and do fumigation with hydrogen peroxide one part by one part. The outcome is shown on the next slide in the closed unit. The closed unit that I mentioned, meaning that the unit like ICU, the unit like OR, that you have the space that contained by the window and door, and the outcome is quite good in the closed unit. Having said that, in slide 36, in the open unit, the outcome is not quite good. As you can see here, before on the left and after on the right, and you can see that there are some fungus growing on after fumigating, and this finding is not surprising because on slide 37, you can see clearly that the environment allowing the hospital in open unit that keep the door and window open all the time will be dirty, because you can anticipate that because it's connected to the dirty environment there. And on slide 38, if you ask me that fumigation with other products produce the same result, we have a chance to experiment the quaternary ammonium salt-based solution combined with two alcohol types. And what we found is that in a closed unit, it worked quite well to reduce both bacteria and fungal bioburden within 6 hours, 1 day, and 7 days. But there is a tendency that the fungal bioburden and bacterial bioburden will grow up again on day 14. So the lesson that we have learned is that aerial decontamination using vaporizer and aerosolize is only a part of the room area decontamination strategy and cannot be used as a standalone intervention. And that if you want to open the hospital, other intervention might be helpful, including the use of HEPA filtration, the UV light, and etc., and filter as well. On slide 40, this incident is going on up to 6 months. We're still identifying some fungus outbreak, and this particular situation occurring in the operating unit because there's one patient had the head trauma and went to the OR. And at that time, we have 20 OR and the OR that have passed the standard of fungal bioburden is only 10. But this patient has emergency surgery, so he went to the 11th room. And as a result, he spiked fever after the surgery, shown in slide 41. As you can see, there's a big spike of fever after surgery on day 1, 2, 3, and the neurosurgeon is kind of worried about the patient, so they started the patient with spectrum antibiotics, and they did LP. On slide 40, the LP result yield 3 types of fungus infection, and they call ID consultation on day 4. As you can see here, on day 4, the fever starts to defoliate, and we look at the patient, and the patient has no clinical evidence of meningitis at all. So we talked to the surgeon that this is not a true infection, and we are experiencing now again a pseudo outbreak due to 3 different types of mold. Having said that, our colleague surgeon would like us to investigate as well, and at that time we switched antibiotics to a narrow spectrum antibiotic, and then we investigate on slide 42 the site that they do the lumbar puncture, and also we talked to the intern that do the lumbar puncture on this patient, and it told us that they wear appropriate PPE with no doubt, but one thing that they also mentioned is the patient is very difficult to LP, so they opened the container that received the LP fluid 30 minutes. So at that time, we have a hypothesis that actually contamination of the air to the container might be a potential source of the pseudo outbreak. So we did sampling at many sites, and we inspect many sites, including since July 43 in the supply site, in the site of the nursing station, in the site around the patient, and on the slide 45, our site contains different type of fungus that similar to the patient had from the LP fluid. So this represents the incidence of pseudo outbreak due to three types of mold after major flooding as well. And slide 46, even though it is a pseudo outbreak, but it leads to unnecessary buildup and antifungal exposure. And in this particular situation, the patient has additional CT and also repeat LP to just show that there's no fungus grow on the LP fluid. Having said that, we documented totally of 6 outbreaks, but we have to do investigation for the mold during 6 month period. And in this particular circumstance, initial fungal bioburden that beyond 500 colony forming units was associated with pseudo outbreak due to mold. So clearly this is the new cut point that we identified. On slide 61, I'm sharing with you the fungal sampling that we obtained from all the units from first floor to the ninth floor. And if you think that flooding only affected first floor, you are wrong, because we detected our fungal from the first floor to the ninth floor. There are many types of fungus that isolated from our laboratory, including Aspergillus, Penicillium, Microspora, and Papillomyces, with a lot of species reside in that genus. And this is not surprising, because these are environmental fungus. If you look at slide 43, you can see clearly that pre-flood and post-flood on the right and left show clearly how dirty the environment is. And on 54, on initial checkup on the first day that we opened the hospital, it clearly suggests that the total bacterial bioburden and fungal bioburden is higher in open ventilation units compared to the closed unit in a statistically significant manner. And a high bacterial and fungal bioburden were detected only in units with excess humidity, and all areas with the fungal pseudo outbreak had excess humidity. And by multivariate analysis, the first floor unit were associated with excess fungal and bacterial bioburden. Invasive infection due to Aspergillus has been notoriously reported in many high-risk patients, including the hematologic stem cell transplant recipients, a solid organ transplant patient, a prolonged neutropenia patient, a preterm neonate. Also, most of the outbreak links to the cause, including no HEPA filtration, poor maintenance of air filtration, poorly sealed windows and walls, a positive pressure are not maintained, and no patient precaution when outside of units and the construction in or nearby hospital, or there are some disturbance of normally closed space. Particularly, most of the time, the source can be unknown. There are many links of surgical site infection due to Aspergillus in the literature, including a lot of procedure involved, including endocarditis, neurotitis, burn wound infection, prosthetic joint replacement, vascular graft, and most of the time this is linked to a heavy contamination of OR air intake and contamination of insulation or air filtration, and also sometimes contaminating of irrigating fluid or wound dressing is linked to this outbreak as well. Another type of infection that I would like to share today is bacterial infection. The next slide, on slide 60, sharing with you, if I would like to say a good thing about flooding. The only thing I can say is that our hospital achieved a termination of XDIA bomb isolate after flooding, And this is the data sharing with you that before the flood, we experiencing the outbreak of XVIA bomb, and no matter what infection control we do, we can reduce it by 25%. But after the hospital is closed, we have repeated environmental cleaning, we have used repeated hydrogen peroxide wafer, this resulting in a sustained XVIA bomb eradication for at least 6 months. So it is the lesson that we learned, that if you want to eradicate it in the air in your hospital, just get flooded. Slide 51 suggests that the clone before the outbreak will belong to the same clone except the three clones, the three isolates that did not belong to the same clone. So we're experiencing some outbreak going on there. On slide 62, this sharing with you that this is not a local issue. We did a national survey on 15 provinces in Thailand, and we see the same trend that all MDR organism is declining, but we see a much higher incidence of the fungal infection after the flooding. The next slide sharing with you that nosocomial infection post-flood not really changes, but we see a significant drop in many types of MDR organisms, except for mold. On slide 64, there are many bacteria and virus that the government would like us to monitor, including leptospirosis, hepatitis A, dengue, hemorrhagic fever, pneumonia from Legionella, measles, tuberculosis, infected conjunctivitis, and viral diarrhea. Having said that, in slide 65, the government did not mention anything about melioidosis. But what we found is that we found 5 cases of melioidosis in a month, and our hospital did not locate it in the area where melioidosis is prevalent. And the unique feature of these patients, including they have no traditional underlying disease, they have a quick presentation within 5 days, and have such a high melioid type and has a high fulminant clinical process. On slide 66, sharing with you that majority of cases has been diagnosed with pneumonia or aspiration pneumonia, and clearly related to a 3 meter high of the flood water in our Pathum Thani area, and all cases have such a high melioid titer, has no traditional risk factor, and were treated inappropriately with ceftriaxone initially until we detected 2 to 4 days later on, and we treated the patient with antibiotics that's supposed to provide it to melioidosis, including ceftazidime with Dactrin. Slide 67, sharing with you another threat that you can see with the major flooding is the mycobacterial infection. On slide 68, there are reported outbreak of mycobacterial lepidopteran or mycobacterial toxinum that link to water supply. And in this instance, it occurred in the University of Texas medical branches as Galveston, and they detected 26 cases of a lepid growing bacterial and assumed that this was contaminated from the source in community and get into the water system in the hospital system, and they did a pulse gel electrophoresis and sharing that this belonged to the same clone. And we suggest that the outbreak of rapid growing mycobacterial can contaminate the water supply. On slide 69, surveillance for healthcare worker health is important as well. Although mold may not do harm to immunocompetent patients, but it has some medical issue related to the mold exposure, and this issue linked to exposure to inhaled spore, fungal fragments, and mycotoxins, and they link to many diseases, including allergic reaction, toxic effects, and invasive infection, and most of the time is linked to exposure to both either high fungal load or a chronic exposure to the fungal bioburden. But for sure, on slide 21, more exposure, even though it did not do harm, it may cause allergy and asthma. And there are some data in the United States that 10% of the general U.S. population have IgE antibody to a common inhaled mold, and the sensitization of the fungus, especially Alternaria, has been linked to the presence and severity of the asthma as well. Having said that, there's no clear data for mold-causing allergic rhinitis to present. On slide 72, the mold exposure can cause a rare lung disease, including the disease called allergic bronchopulmonary aspergillosis, which is an IgE-mediated disease in asthma and cystic fibrosis patients that normally patients will present with wheezing, eosinophilia, pulmonary infiltrate, as called with necrotic flux, and another disease called hypersensitive pneumonitis that has been linked to either high dose and or prolonged exposure to the fungus, and the patient usually presents with the fever, chill, malaise, nausea, cough, chest tightness, and dyspnea without breathing. Another type that you need to pay attention and need to monitor is the asbestos exposure, because chronic asbestos exposure can cause mesothelioma and asbestosis to the exposed healthcare worker. On slide 42, I just want to make a 5 to 10 minute summary of the lesson that we have learned. On slide 25, if you are interested in this work, we have uploaded in the website that I mentioned to you already, and you can find it there. It's reporting the experience of the flood and we review the healthcare-associated infections and that prevention after extensive flood. In brief, I would like to summarize again that there are three types of infection that you can expect to see after the flood. First is the bacterial, and you can expect that you will see gram-negative enteric bacteria like Vibrio and Aeromonas species, and most of the time the risk factor has been linked to contamination of water source and internal plumbing, that the preventive measure, including the periodic potable water quality assessment and also environmental cleaning. Another type of bacteria is Legionella, has been linked to a contamination of water and internal plumbing as well, and also the preventive measure has been to perform periodic potable water quality assessment and investigating a point source, and sometimes you need to remediate it with a chlorine dioxide and then copper silver ionization of water sources. For MBRO, as I mentioned, the hospital that lack of environmental cleaning policy might expect to see an increasing in MBRO, but if you have a good policy on environmental cleaning and good infection control practice, you can achieve a less in MBRO incidence per our experience. Another group of infection is mycobacterial infection. The one that you need to put particular interest is the non-tuberculosis mycobacterial, because it's an environmental mycobacterial that main risk factor came from contaminated laboratory, contaminated water source, and contaminated iron machine and drinking water, and sometimes contaminated in patient's sputum as well. And in this particular case, you need to do a periodic water quality assessment and remove contaminants from water source if detected, and do a prompt investigation after case detection. Even a case of NTM after flooding should raise and highlight alert for you to do an outbreak investigation for NTM after flooding. Another group of infection is the mold infection, and you are expected to see environmental molds, many kinds of them, including Aspergillus species, Penicillium species, Fusarium species, and most of the time the risk factor has been linked to a high fungal rubber burden, no HEPA filtration, contamination of HEPA system, and poor maintenance of filtration. And sometimes if you have construction or demolition in or nearby the hospital, this may be a risk associated with the mold infection. The preventive measure might include a repeated and thorough environmental cleaning, a serial monitoring of the fungal aerosol burden, and consider using a special approach, including hydrogen vaporizer in high-risk units, and contain the construction site and have a frequent, more scheduled maintenance for the HIPAA or HIPAA system. On the slide 77, I share with you when you want to reopen the hospital system after major flooding, you have a lot of work to do. One of the work to do is to make sure that you do the sampling and do maintenance HVAC system or ventilation air conditioning system by frequent maintenance schedule, more than usual, and make sure that air filtration is working properly, there's no obstruction, and you should perform periodic sampling to assess bioaerosol level. The second thing to do is to do the active and laboratory-based post-op surveillance for many organisms that I mentioned, including gram-negative enteric bacteria, mold, mycobacterial, and legionella. Also, you need to monitor for any potential outbreak and pseudo outbreak after post-op. You may experience the outbreak that we achieve after the flood. After this process, after you detect the key pathogen, you should start investigating for potential outbreak by assess laboratory unit for contamination. Secondly, you need to assess the central supply unit for contamination as well. Third, you need to assess bacteria and fungal bioaerosol in affected units as well. And lastly, you need to monitor basic infection prophylaxis in affected units as well. After that, you should implement infection control measures, including using appropriate cleaning and disinfection, periodic evaluation of performance and compliance, assess water quality if indicated, and consider using special aerated contamination approach like hydrogen peroxide vapor in high-risk units. And then you need to consider repeat decontamination process as indicated. I think with the time and experience, I think I would conclude my talk here. Thank you very much for your attention, and thanks for inviting me to join this symposium. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for that presentation. And it's that's a fascinating insight, and I can certainly relate to components of that because of the damage that we suffered locally post-earthquake and to our infrastructure. That we were surprised in many ways that we didn't have more waterborne infections as a result of the damage to our water system. But certainly some food for thought there, particularly around those pseudo-infections, I think. And I was particularly interested in your use of the hydrogen peroxide as a decontamination method, because I know that internationally now that's being looked at more and more closely as an option for us in infection prevention. One question, I suppose, relates to were there changes made prior to the hospital reopening in terms of when it was renovated and obviously the construction changes made to the layout or to prevent further future flooding? Were there preventive methods put into the renovation? I suppose what I'm asking.
Yeah, that is a great question, because we discussing about the potential of the major flooding again, and the lesson that we learned from this is that if you want to prevent the damage, the unit like negative pressure unit, radiology unit should move to the higher level, like the second level. And secondly, if you can design a tight wall that are waterproof, that can be waterproof, that would be very helpful as well. And third, in the unit that perform a toxic substance like chemotherapy or radiation, it should consider moving to a higher floor as well, because most of the Thai hospital, those units were designed to locate it at the underground floor and also on the first floor, which is not safe enough from our experience.
Well, some very useful learnings then from that experience. So in closing, I'd like to thank Dr. Apisan Palamek for his fascinating session this afternoon. Thank you very much for that contribution to weather training. Although we're unable to take questions via the phone line, I'm very happy to pass any queries or questions that you have about the presentation on to him. So please don't hesitate to use the email address which is on your slide. So thanks once again to our speaker and also to our patron sponsors of weather training. And on your penultimate slide, you'll see forthcoming teleclasses for the rest of July. So thank you very much for joining us today and look forward to talking to you again in the future. Bye for now.
Okay, thank you for the invitation. Bye.